Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Welcome back to The Faith Explained, everybody. This is Cale Clark. This is our series, The Biblical Roots of the Papacy. Now, in the last episode, and if you missed it, check the archives, the Relevant Radio app, relevantradio.com, wherever you get your podcasts. We talked about really the granddaddy of them all, the big-time passage that you need to know about the papacy, Matthew chapter 16. Jesus renames Peter as the rock, gives him the keys, binding and loosing, all that stuff. But there is more. Now, there are actually a lot of passages that we will not have time to cover in this series about the papacy in the Bible. But I also want to talk right now about the Gospel of John, because there are some key passages in John's Gospel that have reference to the papacy. Now, of course, in John chapter 1, Jesus also, just as he does in Matthew, calls Peter Kephas, rock. And then we see in chapter 10. Now, chapter 10 of John's Gospel is really crucial because it's one of the I am statements of Jesus. There are the famous I am statements that he makes. I am the way, the truth, and the life. John 14, 6. There are so many more. Here's what he says in John chapter 10. I am the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. We could go through that entire passage. It's really fascinating. And it's interesting that he uses the phrase, I lay down my life for the sheep, because in the ancient world, in Jesus' day, that's exactly what a shepherd would do. And Jesus talks about the good shepherd laying down his life, but the wolf is the one that you got to be afraid of. He says, and the thief as well. He says, the thief only comes to steal, kill, and destroy, but I have come that you might have life and have it to the full. Now, he's obviously comparing the devil to a thief who wants to do some sheep stealing. And what the shepherd would do in the ancient world is he would literally lie across the gate to the sheep pen, and he would sleep there, ever vigilant, to guard against the wolf, to guard against the thief. But here's what he says in John chapter 10. Well, I want to look in particular at this little passage here in John chapter 10, verse 16. Jesus says, I have other sheep that are not of this fold, or this sheepfold, or the sheep pen. I must bring them also, and they will heed my voice. So there shall be one flock, one shepherd. Okay, now that's a crucial verse. John 10, 16. And what's he talking about when he says, I have other sheep that are not of the sheep pen? He's talking about the Gentiles. Because obviously when Jesus is preaching, he's preaching to his fellow Jews. And the Gentile mission is ultimately in view in the big picture. The first Christians, the first Catholics were, of course, Jewish. All the apostles, Mother Mary, Jesus himself being Jewish. But the Gentile mission was always part of the plan to reconcile all people in the one body of the church. And that's why Jesus says, I have other sheep, and I must bring them also, and they will heed my voice. Now, in his book, Upon This Rock, which is a very good book, I highly recommend it, by Stephen Ray, Ray says this, quote, the primary thrust of these words is that Jesus is expanding his covenant to include Gentile believers, but they also emphasize Jesus' desire for the visible unity of the Christian community. It is clear from Jesus' words that the church should never be divided into many separate folds, competing flocks with disunited shepherds, end of quote. So that's very true. The purpose was to bring both Jew and Gentile together into one body, but never should there be separate sheepfolds with separate shepherds, as it were. And that's kind of what we see in the Protestant world with all the disunity there. And I'm going to talk about that as well, because he also gives a quote, and it's from a Protestant scholar of the Reformation named J.H.M. Daubigné. And he wrote about Martin Luther, who touched off the Protestant Revolution, obviously, in 1517, when he nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But only 2 years after this, now Luther became hardened in his views later on and even more extreme. But in the beginning, he wasn't necessarily looking for a separation from the Roman Church. In fact, he was concerned about a lot of the abuses, the corruption that was happening in the Catholic Church at the time. And there was. The church is always in need of reform. The church is always in need of conversion. Sorry. Same is true with us, with you and me. We need it all the time, constantly. So 2 years after he touched off the Protestant Revolution, in the year 1519, Martin Luther wrote to the Pope of the time, Leo X. And here's what he said. Quote, "That the Roman Church is honored by God above all others is what we cannot doubt. St. Peter, St. Paul, 46 popes, many hundreds of thousands of martyrs have shed their blood in its bosom and have overcome hell and the world so that God's eye regards the Roman Church with a special favor. Although everything is now in a very wretched state there, this is not a sufficient reason for separating from it. On the contrary, the worse things are going on within it, the more we should cling to it. For it is not by separation that we shall make it better. We must not desert God on account of the devil, or abandon the children of God who are still in the Roman communion because of the multitude of the ungodly. There is no sin, there is no evil that should destroy charity or break the bond of union. For charity can do all things into unity. Nothing is difficult." End of quote. That's incredible. Luther himself is basically saying there is no good reason to separate from the Roman Catholic Church. Now, did he change his mind down the road? Yes, he did. But in the beginning, when he touched off his program, separation from the church wasn't really in his view. That there were lots of factors going in there, political and otherwise, and things went the way that they did. But he never in the beginning approved any kind of schism from Rome. It's important to know that. The unity of the church, just as Jesus wanted in John's gospel. Another passage we have to look at from John is in John chapter 17. And this is, again, a profound passage. Really, really deep theology, Jesus' high priestly prayer before he enters into his passion. And here's a selected passage here. This is from John chapter 17, verses 20 through 23. And this is what Jesus says, quote, "I do not pray for these only," and that's the guys in front of him, the apostles, "but also for those who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one. Even as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory which you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one, I in them, and you in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them, even as you have loved me." End of quote. I don't think Jesus could have belabored the point anymore. And he's not belaboring it, but he's making it crystal clear that they may be one, even as you and I are one, Father. This idea of the unity of the persons in the Trinity has to be the hallmark of the church as well. The unity. Just as there are three persons in one God, all of us in the church have to have a perfect unity. That's the goal. That's the goal. And so the reason for this, Jesus says, that the world would know that you have sent me. The proof, if you will, the proof is in the pudding. And really, the pudding is this, that the unity of the church should be a sign to the world of the reality of the unity of Jesus and the Father. And so when we don't have that unity, that's a stumbling block to the world. That's a scandalon, as it says in Greek in the New Testament. It's a stumbling stone. A lot of people get tripped up because they take a look at Christianity and they say, these guys can't even agree with one another. Why should I become a Christian? They can't even agree on what the church is supposed to be. Think about the Catholics, the Orthodox churches of the East, all the various Protestant denominations. And to my best knowledge, there are about 34,000 plus Protestant denominations in the world right now, not counting the so-called free church movement, the independent Bible churches that you see in your neighborhoods. And so these guys can't even get their own act together and agree with one another. Why should I join this group? Now, that might be a cop-out. You might say that, yeah, but we can't deny the fact that it is a stumbling stone. And so Jesus doesn't want this. It's not his ideal by any stretch of the imagination. And my wife and I pick this as the gospel reading for our wedding mass, because we wanted the unity in our marriage and our family to be somehow assigned to the world of the unity of the of God and of the church as well. And so in some small and imperfect way. But that's really what Jesus wants. It has to be seen. It has to be seen. People have to see it to believe it. And this really goes back to something else that Jesus said in the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 18. This is known as the community discourse in Matthew. And this is a passage from there. This is Matthew 18, verses 15 through 18. Jesus says, "If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you've gained your brother. But if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Truly, I say to you, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Now, when people read that, they say, aha, Jesus is giving all the apostles the authority to bind and loose. Well, yeah, they do have authority. They are the apostles. They are, of course, the forerunners of the bishops. Their successors become the bishops. So yeah, bishops have huge authority given to them by Christ. The fullness of holy orders, if you will. And I always look at holy orders like a lamp with three notches. As you click it, you turn it on, the brightness increases every time. It's an imperfect analogy, to be sure, but there is, of course, the holy orders that involve the diaconate. So you go deacon, and then click it up another notch. The priesthood, click it up another notch. It's the episcopate. It's the bishopric. It's becoming a bishop, the fullness of holy orders. So Jesus shares his powers with the apostles and the bishops, and the bishops share their powers with guys that are known as the priests, gives them the ability to consecrate the Eucharist, to confect the Eucharist at Mass. And then the deacons share in the office of Christ the servant. And so the fullness of holy orders, obviously, is possessed by the bishop, but that's not really the point here. Yeah, he gives them all that authority. And the reason why people sometimes point at this passage is because they say, well, what about Matthew 16? They say, doesn't it seem here that Jesus is giving all the authority to all the apostles, not Peter alone? Well, they all have this authority, but again, Peter has this unique authority, even among his own brethren, even among the apostles themselves. And in Matthew 16, remember, it was singular in Greek when Jesus says, "I'm giving you the keys, whatever you bind and loose." And in this passage, yeah, he's giving it to the rest of them as well. But you've got to take it all in context of the entire Gospel of Matthew and other scriptures as well. But one of the reasons why I wanted to bring up this little passage here in Matthew chapter 18 is because of the visible nature of the church. Again, Jesus is asking in John's gospel for unity in the church, a visible unity so that the world would know that he's been sent by the Father. If you have a problem with someone, Jesus says, first try to talk to this person one-on-one. And let's escalate it up the chain as necessary. It may be that you talk to this person, you make a fraternal correction, and they say, yeah, what I was doing was wrong. Thank you for pointing that out. And they mend their ways and ask God for forgiveness, and everything's fine after that. It's not always the case, though. It's not always the case. Jesus says, all right, if this person does not listen, take one or two others along with you. Why? Again, a matter in a Jewish court of law has to be established by two or three witnesses. And so, all right, group intervention doesn't work. Then what? If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. So here's the question. If you're going to tell it to the church, which church? Which church? How would, as Steve Ray says in his book, what church can a Baptist brother take his Methodist brother for reproof and judgment? The words of our Lord are reduced to nonsense in the age of ever-dividing factions, independent sects, and groups. Which church? That's a great question. The point of the matter is that there should be one church, a visible church. It has to be visible. It's not this idea of invisible unity. And this is what a lot of non-Catholic Christians like to say. Well, yeah, we might be externally divided, but hey, there's this internal unity among all Christians. Well, really? Didn't Jesus ask for a visible unity so that all would know, even unbelievers would know? So this is a really important passage, Matthew 18, in light of what we see Jesus saying in John's Gospel, in John chapter 17. So this is very important. And another thing that Steve Ray says in his book, and he said in another work that he wrote called Crossing the Tiber, it was a conversion story, his own conversion story, published by Ignatius Press, and Upon This Rock, also published by Ignatius Press, by the way. Crossing the Tiber is actually the first book that I read when I was coming back into the Catholic Church, and I was delving into the evidence for Catholicism. So thanks to him for writing it, and I appreciate that, Steve, and it really helped me a lot. One of the things he said in that book, and he also says it in his book on the papacy, is that it's intriguing that a lot of non-Catholic Christians kind of fight against this idea of a pastor, of a pope for the universal church. It's intriguing because in their own Protestant denominational congregations or independent Bible churches, if you will, there's always a pastor. And he basically says, how come there can be a pastor in your individual church, but you think this whole idea of God installing a pastor over the universal church is nuts? It seems like just an extrapolation of the fact that, yeah, a local parish, even in the Catholic Church, needs a pastor. A diocese or an archdiocese needs a bishop, and the universal church can have a universal pastor, the Pope. Really interesting. Here's what he says. He says, quote, "Even the small evangelical or fundamentalist congregation understands the essential need of a pastor, a visible leader and teacher to maintain doctrine, faith, and unity. The shepherd is essential to the duty and coherence of the flock. Christ appointed Peter as the shepherd of his sheep. The shepherd is essential to maintain the unity of the flock. Can we do without a visible shepherd and claim Christ as the only head of the church? What Protestant group would make such an assertion in its own congregation? Did not Jesus appoint Peter as shepherd? Did not even Paul acknowledge shepherds in the church in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11? From ancient times, the Bishop of Rome occupying the See of Peter has been the shepherd of the universal church, maintaining the true faith and the essential unity that the church may be perfected in one visible universal flock. When the unifying office of the Pope is abandoned, the various groups go off in 30,000 different and competing directions. The only unifying factor among them is the denial of papal primacy," end of quote. I think that's well put. And in his book, he goes into a lot of stuff that we won't get into in the series, because he talks about the papacy through history as well, through the early church, and many instances in which papal primacy is asserted through things that happened in history. The Pope's actually exercising universal authority. This is a little bit beyond the scope of our series, because we're looking at the biblical evidence for the papacy, but maybe that would be a good topic for another series down the road. But we do see this. We do see the fact that the universal church needs a universal pastor. Hans Urs von Balthasar, and he's quoted in Ray's book, a very, very well-known theologian of the 20th century. Joseph Ratzinger, who became Benedict XVI, was very fond of his works, and in fact, the two collaborated on a lot of stuff together. This is what Hans Urs von Balthasar said. And by the way, just to clarify, he's going to use the word negation. What he's talking about there when he says negation is negation of papal primacy, a denial of the office of the Pope being necessary. So here's the quote from von Balthasar, quote, "The negation created a purely formal unity." So he's basically saying denying the papal office creates just a formal unity. He goes on to say, "But this unity, deriving from negation within every non-Catholic church as well as between them, remains abstract in content because the most concrete factor of unity has been eliminated. Wherein then lies the unity of the church, the unity of the different local churches, if this focal point is removed? Dollinger, in his early writings, cites a Protestant theologian who said that it is untrue and confusing to speak of unity when this is merely sought after, existing only as a concept, and when nothing can be presented that shows the alleged unity numerically. That is why the Anglican Newman," this Cardinal Newman, of course, St. John Henry Cardinal Newman, "complained that the then existing unity of the English church was abstract. In truth, one should speak about churches, individual, end of quote. All right, so that was Hans Urs von Balthasar, and that work was called, the quote derived from was called The Office of Peter and the Structure of the Church, again, published by Ignatius Press, 1986. So von Balthasar sees it too. This idea of an abstract unity is not what Jesus asked for. And it's very nebulous. It has to be concrete. It has to be visible. And again, the world has to see it in order to believe it. We'll have much more on the papacy in the Bible in the next episode of The Faith Explained. But now it's time to open up the Q&A mailbag. And once again, you can send me your questions, faith@relevantradio.com. Let's do it. Okay, so our question today, and once again, you can email the mailbag here at The Faith Explained. The address is faith@relevantradio.com, or you can try getting your question to me on Twitter. My handle is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Now, this question comes via email, and it's from Mary Rose, who's listening to the show in San Francisco, California, on 1260 AM, KSFB. And here's her message. She says, "Hi, Cale. I love listening to your shows on Relevant Radio. My mother-in-law recently visited us, and she appears to be a closeted atheist. She grew up in the Baptist church and told my husband that in her youth, someone in the church told her that her friend who is Jewish won't go to heaven, and she uses that bad advice as an excuse to not believe in God. Now, the reason I say that she's a closeted atheist is because she knows I am Catholic and won't challenge me to my face. Instead, she feeds my husband, who is not Catholic, her talking points. As an example, she took us on a trip to Italy several years ago, which was very generous and very lovely. On our trip, we stopped in Siena at the cathedral, and while my daughter and I prayed at a side altar, she said to my husband, 'You know this is all a bunch of hocus pocus, right?' Well, fast forward to the most recent trip when she had my husband alone by himself, and she said to him, 'You know, there are only 5 words that can actually be traced to Jesus. Cale, this is where I need your help. Do you know what she might be referencing when she makes this claim? She is someone whom you would consider to be an East Coast liberal,' and goes on to say, 'I'm guessing there must be a popular atheist thinker who is espousing this talking point. Thank you and God bless you, Cale. By the way, hearing your daughter Michaela's voice at the end of your afternoon program is a highlight of my day. I also have an only daughter who is already 17. I miss those sweet younger days. Kind regards, Mary Rose." Thank you so much for your beautiful email, Mary Rose. And yeah, we certainly have to enjoy the time that we have with our kids because it goes so quickly. I really appreciate that. But with respect to your mother-in-law and her closeted atheism, if you will, I'm not quite sure what she's referencing when she says that there are only 5 words that can actually be traced to Jesus. I don't know if somebody is propagating this or what those 5 words might be. There are, of course, the famous 7 last words of Jesus from the cross. I don't know if that's what she's referencing, but do be assured that we can trust that what the New Testament, what the Gospels say about Jesus' teaching, that is authentically the teaching of Jesus. I've dealt with this on many occasions, and we don't have the what scholars call the ipsissima verba. That's a Latin term which means the actual words of Jesus, but we do have the ipsissima vox. We do have the authentic voice of Jesus there. So what they do with the teaching of Christ is they sometimes condense it to fit the situation, to fit the space, obviously. As I mentioned just a couple of days ago on the program, we have some speeches of the Lord. The Sermon on the Mount, for example, is a great example. Matthew 5 through 7, those chapters. Now, the Gospels tell us that Jesus would preach for hours to crowds. It kept him spellbound, as you might imagine, because his teaching was sublime, the God-man. And even the authorities in John's Gospel didn't arrest him. They came back and they said, "Man, nobody ever talked like this guy. Why didn't you arrest him? Oh, we were just listening, man. We were eating it up." And so they're obviously summarizing a bunch of stuff, but as a rabbinical students, this was the way it was done. You weren't supposed to parrot your teacher and play back like a recording everything he said word for word. You got the gist of the message, and you could expand it and contract it based on the situation you're in. If you're in an elevator with somebody, as it were, you have to have an elevator pitch for the gospel, and so you can make it really short, 1 or 2 minutes long, or you can expand it. If you have hours to spend with somebody over a cup of coffee or something like that, maybe a stronger beverage, I don't know. You can certainly expand the time and fill in more detail, more color. But the important thing is to get the accuracy right. You weren't allowed to alter your teacher's message. You weren't allowed to make it up. And Jesus himself did this, by the way. In Luke's gospel, there's the Sermon on the Plain, as it's called. It takes place at a level place. And some people think, oh, it's just Luke taking the Sermon on the Mount and cutting it and pasting it a little bit, making it shorter. Maybe not, because Jesus, when he preached in the synagogues in Galilee, he was traveling around, same basic message of the kingdom of God, but he might have had less time in this particular location. Who knows what was going on? He can expand and contract it as well. But with regard to, here's something you can maybe tell your mother-in-law. With regard to Jesus in history, we can know an awful lot. There was a scholar named E.P. Sanders who worked a lot on the life of Jesus of Nazareth. And by the way, this guy, E.P. Sanders, did not think that the Bible was 100% reliable himself. I disagree with him on that. But he did give a list of things, facts, that every scholar and historian can know with virtual certainty about the life of Jesus. So he originally had a shorter list, but he expanded it up to 15. And here are the 15 facts that from history we can know about Jesus, even without admitting the Bible as the Word of God. Number one, Jesus was born around the year 4 BC, around the time of the death of Herod the Great. How can Jesus be born before Christ, if you will, in the BC period? Well, the monks got the dates a little bit wrong because Herod, of course, is still alive when Jesus is born. Number two, he spent his childhood and early adult years in Nazareth, a Galilean village. Number three, he was baptized by John the Baptist or John the Baptizer. Number four, he called disciples. Number five, he taught in towns, villages, and countrysides of Galilee, not so much in the cities. Number six, he preached a message about the kingdom of God. Number seven, about the year AD 30, he went to Jerusalem for the Passover. Number eight, he created a disturbance in the temple area. Number nine, he had a final meal with his disciples. Number 10, he was arrested and interrogated by Jewish authorities, specifically the high priest. Number 11, he was executed on the orders of the Roman prefect Pontius Pilate. Number 12, his disciples at first ran away and fled. Number 13, they saw him. In what sense? People can argue about that. We say resurrected, of course. They said that they saw him after his death. I'm just saying what historians would say about this. Number 14, as a consequence, they believed he would return to found the kingdom. And number 15, they formed a community, which we call the church, to await his return and sought to win others to faith in him as God's Messiah. So those are 15 historical facts that virtually all historians and scholars of history can agree upon, no matter what they personally believe about the life and teaching of Jesus of Nazareth. We can actually construct quite a bit of Jesus' teaching from historical sources and about his life as well. So hopefully that will help your mother-in-law, Mary Rose, but I do appreciate you writing in, and please do so anytime. And thanks for listening to the program. And yep, you'll hear Michaela, her voice, at the end of my show later on today called The Cale Clark Show, live on Relevant Radio at 5 p.m. Central. Hope you'll join me for that. And certainly join me for the next episode of The Faith Explained, 12:30 Central, and also on the Relevant Radio app and relevantradio.com. Send me your question, faith@relevantradio.com. Until next time, I'm Cale Clark. God bless you. Peace.